mentioned earlier, we have the good fortune to have guests today from Bethany College. And by offering them the kindness of accommodation, we're in a fine position of being able to exploit you, which is why Tyler is preaching shortly. But remember, we're also following this modern confession of faith. It's a contemporary creed written by Marjorie McCaskill just a few years ago. This morning, I still want to touch on it, however briefly. She says, I believe that there is no better revelation of God than Jesus, the Christ, who is the living Word of God, who for our sakes took on human flesh, lived our life, died our death, and rose again before us and for us. Now, with that in mind, let's talk about pretense and pretending, disguise and deception, and ultimately revelation. A couple of weeks back, I was over in the East Nuke of Fife, Anstruther to be exact, and was upset to discover that a very old and historical tavern had closed its doors. Nothing new there. Well-intended legislation sometimes has unforeseen outcomes. Anti-smoking legislation, which in years to come will be hailed as an immense step forward in the health of this nation, and changed drink driving legislation have combined, along with cheap alcohol in supermarkets, to slowly strangle the economic life out of many pubs. They simply cannot make ends meet. And despite the importance of pubs, along with churches and corner shops, to the pulse beat of communities, they're shutting down at a frightening rate. The Dreel Tavern, on the banks of the Dreel Burn, which flows into the Forth on the shores of West and East Anstruther, is simply another victim of this convergence of laws and circumstance. Its beautiful 300-year-old building stands empty and neglected, a shell where once it was a shelter and a gathering place. And its name, the Dreel Tavern, has ancestry and history and legend, if you care to dig a bit deeper. Not least the legend that one stormy night in 1533, the young James V of Scotland, sometimes known as a poor man's king because he was given to travelling incognito through his kingdom in order to understand better what life was like for his people. And at the same time, Scotland was still reeling from the devastation of the Battle of Flodden 20 years earlier. So James was in the habit of taking the pulse of the nation by travelling incognito across the land. And the story is told that James arrived at the banks of the Dreel Burn with another 9 miles to go before he might arrive at St Andrews. But he could not or would not cross the frothing Dreel because the burn was in spate and the incoming tide was high. But he charmed a young girl, a widow called Phoebe, to carry him over the waters, because he wasn't so common that he wanted to get his breeks wet. And he rewarded her, goes the legend, with a night of passion and a purse when he left at daybreak. An author by the name of Christopher Rush tells that story best, of the king who pretended to be a commoner, but ultimately acted with the kindness and generosity that befits a good ruler of a kingdom. And when he left, Phoebe knew who had shared her bed. Disguise had led to revelation and a kind of joy. A few days ago, a young Muslim called Salman Abedi found his way into the Manchester Arena, pretending to be, perhaps, a member of staff, maybe a cleaner, or simply one of the concert goers. Strapped around him was a bomb which, once exploded, ended the lives of 22 people, maiming many more, horrifying millions. What might we call the action of the equally youthful King James V? Passionate? Seductive? Mischievous? Generous? There was pretense, yes, but the disguise, broadly speaking, was to understand better, not to harm. In Salmon Abedi's case, the disguise was for darker reasons. No desire to understand, only to harm, only to destroy. Now, hop back to Marjorie McCaskill's confession of faith. I believe there is no better revelation of God than Jesus. She is not saying that Jesus is the only way of recognizing God present and entwined in this world. She is not saying that churches are good and mosques, synagogues, temples are bad. She is not saying that Jesus is the only way and every other way is the wrong way. But she is saying that we are God-created beings. She is saying with wonderful honesty and simplicity that she believes that Jesus is the best revelation we have of the very nature of God. How can we possibly know what God is like, someone might ask, if they decide that there are more important things in life than having a shiny car and 130 channels on our TV? And the Christian can reply with confidence which is not arrogance. God is like you see in Jesus, compassionate and healing, forgiving, seeking out justice, reaching out to those whom society too easily ignores or marginalizes. And there is no deception here. Despite the birth in poverty and the death in tragedy, there is no deception. But a little like King James V, it seems that God also chose to travel incognito in his kingdom. Not in order to catch people out, but to be one with them. He did not walk this earth in Jesus to cause harm or to cause hurt, but rather to bring healing and reconciliation, humankind with itself and humankind with its maker. So, to some degree, yes, there is disguise, but no deception. There is disguise in as much as Jesus lives and works amongst us, just another peasant, just another carpenter, until the time is right for him to leave his Father's business and take up his Father's business. Ultimately, what all three stories offer is revelation. The moment when the fisher lass realized that the young man she carries on her back across the raging, frothing drill is indeed her king. The moment, a terrifying, slow, unwinding moment, when thousands of folk in the Manchester Arena realize the full horror of what has happened and is happening. And the moment which will happen again and again and again until time is done, when people realize that the man from Nazareth is also God, walking our earth, embracing our dreams and dramas and hurt and hunger and longings and losses, and proclaiming on a blood-stained cross and from an empty tomb that this is the ultimate act of revelation. Behold your God, hiding in plain sight, glory hidden that our fragile faith might discover heaven on earth. God becomes one of us, that we might be one with God. For our sakes, says Marjorie, he took on human flesh, lived our life, died our death, and rose again, before us and for us. That's what we mean when we too casually say, God is revealed in Christ. Not all revelation is destructive. Not all disguise is malevolent. Christ's is a revelation which leaves us free to choose, which is more choice than the unfortunate souls at Manchester Arena were given. And maybe that's the difference between love and hate. One word, choice.
The Word became flesh and made his home among us. We have seen his glory, glory like that of a Father's only Son, full of grace and truth. I want to begin by thanking Ewan for your lovely and important words about the events of the last week in Manchester. I remember when Dylan Roof shot 9 people in Mother Emanuel Church in Charleston, South Carolina, a couple years ago. I went to church the next Sunday, and it wasn't, everything had been planned so perfectly for the service, and the shooting wasn't mentioned at all, and I remember being quite angry. I've been thinking this week as I've prayed for the people of Manchester and, having something somewhat prepared, how is this going to proceed? And I hope that something of the serenity and the stillness of Celtic spirituality in the midst of harsh weather, which thankfully I wasn't, we weren't reminded of when we were on Iona yesterday, and in the midst of very real threats of Viking attacks, that serenity might be of encouragement to you. I should say that our town, of Lindsborg, Kansas, is known as Little Sweden, USA, and our uni's mascot is the Terrible Swede. And having lived in Scotland for a few years before moving to Kansas, it took a long time for me to wear anything branded with a Viking. Having seen the Brock and Lewis, I felt a little bit, uneasy with wearing the Viking gear. It's been about 3.5 years since I've been able to greet a crowd with a hiya. So, hiya! We do bring warm greetings from Kansas. Our town is right smack in the middle of America. So if you look for the very central spots of the continental U.S., we are a 2-hour drive from there. And in America, that's like just a hop and a skip. Rachel Ann, Teddy, and Beau send their love. Colts Kirk has a very special place in our hearts, not least because Teddy experienced his first service of worship here. And the picture that was given to us as a parting gift when we left in 2013 of Colts Kirk still hangs in our home. And this is, I'm feeling a little emotional, a very special place to us. Maybe it's because of the jet lag, but I forgot the prop that I was going to use today. Ewan's so good with props in his children's messages, I thought, I've got to bring a prop, and I left it. But I'll sort of share what that prop would have been. It's a wee stuffed Highland coo. And his name is inspired by events that happened here at Colts Kirk. For some reason, I was invited to be an auctioneer at a fundraising event here one time. And I was handed a block of cheese from the Devonick Dairy, and I asked, what is this cheese called? And someone said, the Kuzalut. And I said, I'm sorry. This was before I mastered Doric. And someone else said, the Kuzalut. And I said, I got nothing. And so finally, exasperated but still patient, somebody else said, the Kuz-a-oot. I said, do you mean the cows are out? Aye. So we have named our Highland coo, our stuffed Highland coo, Kuzarut, and he's been photobombing us different phases of our journey. So we've come from Kansas. We're not all from Kansas. Dr. Melody Steed is our college organist and a professor of music. She's from Iowa. Hannah and Kaylin are from Kansas. Sophie came from Kansas to Bethany, but she's lived kind of all over the place. And Austin and Annie are from Colorado. So why are we here? We've been teaching a course called The Pilgrimage, and it's a travel seminar that we developed for an honors program at Bethany, which is a wee Lutheran College of about 600 or so students. And during the first chunk of the term, during the term time, they earn the first chunk of credit for the course, and they don't get full credit for the course until they've traveled with us abroad. And we've been reading several texts in Celtic spirituality, and I hope it's okay for me to use this term Celtic. The more I read around in it, the more controversial it seems, but I'm just going to use it because that's the easiest thing to do. And this week, we've been following in the magical footsteps of St. Columba, and I believe that my students now believe that unicorns and fairies actually exist. They were asking about the crossing signs, and I said my favorite crossing sign is the unicorn crossing sign, and they believed me. Having read the lives of St. Patrick, St. Bridget, St. Brendan, and of course St. Columba, we've developed an appreciation not only for holy biography, but also the spirit of the earliest days of Christian mission and practice in these isles. Having read about the Lindisfarne Gospels, and we're heading to Holy Island tomorrow, we've caught a visual glimpse of the creativity and the aesthetic sensibilities of early Celtic Christians. Our encounter with the Lindisfarne Gospels was complemented by a viewing of the captivating animated film, The Secret of Kells. Though animated, it's probably not a film for wee ones. I wish you could meet 3.5-year-old Teddy, who censors television shows and movies. We don't even have to like pre-screen them. If they're on and he's watching it and it gets the least bit scary, he said, "This for older kid, Daddy, turn it off." As interesting as it is to consider these texts, not just biographies and illuminated gospels, but poetry and liturgy and sermons and theological treatises, as interesting as it is to consider them as cultural artifacts, I think it's worth asking in what ways the literature and the acts of these early Celtic Christians might challenge our way of being in a post-Christian, technologically advanced West in the 21st century. How might they challenge us, especially to interpret Scripture as relevant for our super-connected yet relationally dysfunctional age? However briefly, I want to meditate on our psalm and the prologue to John's Gospel. And I think we'll see in the former an intimate connection with the world, and indeed the entire universe, one that personalizes the cosmos, hearing the heavens, the sky, the sun, speechless though they be, as words that speak of God. And in the latter, we hear the Word with a capital W, whose incarnation and resurrection is God's loud and jubilant yes to the little W words. This attentiveness to creation, along with a complementary obsession with the incarnation, are hallmarks of Celtic spirituality, and we might do well to follow in their footsteps. A friend of mine, Mari, has taken to calling things like rocks and trees and oceans and flowers non-human persons. She's actually been influenced by the work of an anthropologist at Aberdeen Uni named Tim Ingold, who has studied animistic cultures and the way they relate to non-human creatures. And she says that in Psalms like Psalm 19, the poets aren't simply using metaphorical language, but they actually think that these non-human creatures are really communicating with them. And I get this feeling when I read Psalm 19. It's as if the heavens are reminding us of their source, pleading with us to join in the creation song of praise to God. I'm struck by the way that early Celtic Christians felt a sense of connection to other creatures, especially the ancient elements. Water, for instance, is intensely sacred, mysterious and life-giving, both serene and hostile, something to be deeply respected. When stories about the creation of the waters in Genesis 1 or the Exodus or baptism met the early Celtic Christians, they already had an intense appreciation for things like water. It wasn't difficult for them to relate the gospel to aspects of their pre-Christian religious heritage. So what about their thinking about the one baptized by John in the waters of the Jordan? Eugene Peterson's translation of the prologue to the Gospel of John says that Jesus moved into the neighborhood. Moved into the neighborhood. And I think what I appreciate about John's gospel is it really seems to be a deep reflection on the intense presence of God in the midst of our messiness, as Ewan has already sort of spoken of. And I think there's a Celtic sensibility of divine presence, sensing God in, with, and in a sense in the incarnation as God's creation. And I think my students and my colleague Melody can attest to feeling this strange sense of divine presence when you're on a place like Iona. We kind of had a long and arduous journey to get there, and we called the course a pilgrimage, so it made sense for us to feel completely exhausted when we got to the island. And it felt like as soon as we got there, there was this serenity, this stillness, this presence that made us meditative. And when we went to watch the sunset on the beach, I felt as calm as I've felt in weeks, being partially responsible for students coming abroad and getting... Anyways. And I think that there's... we sort of tried to put ourselves in the place of Columba. You know, what must he have felt when he landed on this island? How did he get food? We saw the beer making area and thought maybe that was, made up for it. I think that's the second piece, the sense of presence that acknowledging the incarnation forces us to meditate upon, that Celtic Christians are sort of contribute to global Christianity. And my takeaway from a sort of very brief Celtic Christian reading of these texts is one that there's a sacrality in all things. We stayed in the Iona hostel, and there were all kinds of notes about how to take care of things. And there was a note in the loos, and it said, this is probably information that you don't need, and that made me inclined to read it because I like reading for fun and no good reason sometimes. And there was just a little note about putting so-called disposable items down the toilet. And just that sense of, calling something disposable and sort of challenging that notion of something being easily disposable was something that I greatly appreciated. I know that in my own age, I feel like I grew up in a culture in which to be is to consume. And being on Iona forced me to think about my consumptive habits, how if something breaks, I just get a new one. I just don't feel like I, think about the problematic nature of very short shelf lives of the things that I buy. And then I think the other piece is this deep sense of God's presence. And feeling God's presence wherever we are, in the midst of our neighbors, in the midst of creation. We really appreciated the commitment to justice of the Iona community and the song that we sang from Jamaica, encouraging us to see God in prisoners, in the people that seem to get most cast about. And then I think the final thing that I would want to point out is just the pleasure and the sense of play. When we read the life of St. Patrick and the life of St. Brendan and the life of St. Bridget and Columba, the students sort of acknowledged a playfulness in the text. Aside from thinking this sounds more like Homer than any literature I've ever read before, just St. Bridget hanging her washing up on sunbeams. That seems kind of playful. And the deep sort of aesthetic sense that we see illustrated for us in the Lindisfarne Gospels. God is greatly delighted when we play and when we don't always bother with thinking about the end purpose of things, but enjoy life in the moment. And I get that perspective from folks who felt a deep sense of God's presence, even in the midst of harsh weather, a very real threat of attacks and so forth, that playfulness that doesn't worry about tomorrow. And so I hope that as we continue on our pilgrimage, if we don't pass out from jet lag and exhaustion, that we'll have this sort of sense of stillness. And being a non-native, thank you for the gifts that you offer to Christians all over the world. And I didn't know until this weekend that Ewan is retiring, and I want to say thank you on behalf of our Wee family and everybody else. I think our 3 years in Aberdeen before we had children were the best 3 years of our marriage, and thanks in no small part to our involvement here at Colts Kirk. And we've taken a lot of the sensibilities that were cultivated in us with us wherever we've gone, and we're incredibly grateful for this Kirk, and we think about you often and love you dearly. So thank you, and God be with you.